and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the response to President Trump's State of the Union from the designated Democrat, not to mention other opposition voices who weighed in, and speak with Paul Waldman, a senior writer at the American Prospect and author of Being Right Is Not Enough, What Progressives Must Learn from Conservative Success, about his article at The Washington Post, What Joe Kennedy's Speech Says About Democratic Anger at Trump. He joins us to discuss how Democrats should resist the call by centrist pundits to reach out to conservative voters, but instead energize and mobilize voters to vote in November using the growing and palpable anger across the land at Trump, which is shared by 57% of the country who feel he is reckless, profane, and sexist, together with the alarm 46% of Americans feel who believe Trump is a greater danger to America and the world than North Korea's Kim Jong-un. Then we'll look into one of the more glaring lies in Trump's hour-and-a-half-long string of jingoistic patriotic platitudes mixed in with hyper-salesmanship, and focus on his claim that, quote, Apple has just announced it plans to invest a total of $350 billion in America and hire another 20,000 workers. This, in fact, is our new American moment. There has never been a better time to start living the American dream. Economist, lawyer, investigative journalist James Henry, the co-founder of the new investigative reporting service DCReport.org, joins us to discuss Trump's massive giveaway to the 1% dressed up as middle-class tax relief and his bogus infrastructure plan, which is based on a disastrous experiment that rewarded contractors but failed miserably for the public in the UK. Then finally, we'll look into the healthcare project put forward by Amazon, JP Morgan Chase, and Berkshire Hathaway that is long on promises and short on details, and speak with Michael Hiltzik, a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and columnist with the Los Angeles Times, about his article at the Los Angeles Times, Reducing Healthcare Costs Doesn't Require Bezos, Buffett, Diamond Magic. Every other country already knows how. We'll try to analyze why so many Republicans cheered Donald Trump at last night's State of the Union when he proudly announced he was taking health care away from millions of his fellow Americans. And joining us now is Paul Waldman, who blogs at the Washington Post's Plumline and is a columnist for The Week, as well as a senior writer at the American Prospect. The author of Being Right Is Not Enough, What Progressives Must Learn from Conservative Success. His latest article at the Washington Post is What Joe Kennedy's Speech Says About Democratic Anger at Trump. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Waldman.
Thank you.
So, of course, Joe Kennedy's was the official Democratic rebuttal. There were other, I guess, voices of the resistance who also spoke. But by and large, Joe Kennedy seemed to get pretty good reviews. And I know that people talked about his lip balm, as you point out, and trivial things. But in general, you know, we've seen some pretty pathetic rebuttals from Bobby Jindal in Louisiana and Marco Rubio, Swilling Water. So how would you rate, I know I'm lowering the bar, Paul, but how would you rate Joe Kennedy?
Well, it was quite good. Maybe not the best ever, but I think one thing they did that was really smart is they put him in front of an audience. You know, ordinarily what happens is the president comes out in front of Congress with all this kind of pageantry, and then you get some guy sitting alone in a quiet room talking to the camera. It works much better. Any speech works better if there's an audience to play off of. So that was smart. And I think that Kennedy's speech was quite well written, and it was a really good kind of appeal to fundamental liberal values. And the reason I decided to write about it was because, you know, we've seen a lot of people giving advice to Democrats lately, as they often do. And one of the things you hear over and over again is that Democrats need to come up with an affirmative, positive agenda, that they can't just be against Trump. And if they just do that, then they're going to lose. Well, I don't think that's true at all. And because we're coming up to a midterm election, and I can go into all the reasons why, but I think that in a midterm election, being just against Trump is not only the politically smart thing to do, it's also the morally righteous thing to do.
Well, of course, as you point out, conservative and centrist pundits are saying that the wise thing would be to reach out to the center and even disaffected conservatives. But one of the problems, or the asymmetry, if you will, between the Democrats and the Republicans is always that the Republicans manage to get every last one of their voters out, whereas Democrats, as Barack Obama once mentioned about midterms, seem to have a genetic problem with voting in midterms. So it really is a question of, in spite of the Republican gerrymandering, if enough Democrats show up in November, which they normally don't do, then they will sweep and the blue wave will become a reality. But they always lack the inspiration. My sense is that it's palpable out there, the anger, the frustration. You just have to look at the polls. Majorities of Americans are just disgusted. Some of them are alarmed. 46% of Americans believe that Trump is a greater danger than Kim Jong-un. And Trump spent an awful lot of time last night in the State of the Union demonizing the North Koreans, and it became clear to me from watching it that this guy really wants to go to war with North Korea.
You know, we're in an extraordinary political moment. I've never seen the Democratic base as activated as it is right now. You know, the indivisible movement has chapters in every single congressional district in America, many chapters in many districts. You've got thousands of people who have signed up to run for office, and it's all based on anger at Donald Trump. And you can make an argument that we've become so polarized that persuasion is now almost impossible, and mobilization is what's even going to win you presidential elections. But it's particularly true in midterm elections. What we always see is that the party that's more energized is the one that wins. And, you know, we had this pattern that people are probably familiar with, where in a president's first midterm election, his party almost always loses seats. And that's because when the president of one party gets elected, the opposition gets mad. And we've seen that over and over again. You know, why was it that Republicans took back Congress in 2010 and 2014? It was because they were angry at Barack Obama. And by the same token, when Democrats took Congress in 2006, they were angry at George W. Bush. So we see this in midterm election after midterm election. The party that's more mad is the one that has its people get motivated to get out and vote. Now, I should say that it's not that, you know, Democrats don't have a positive agenda. If you go to your local congressional candidate and you ask her, you know, what do you think about health care? What do you think about the minimum wage? What do you think about the environment? She'll be able to tell you all the positions she has. Democrats have nothing but policies. But in terms of, you know, what you want to focus on and what's really motivating people to get to the polls, it's those negative emotions that are directed at the president right now.
And again, I'm speaking with Paul Waldman, who blogs at the Washington Post Plumline and is a columnist for The Week, as well as a senior writer at the American Prospect, the author of Being Right Is Not Enough, What Progressives Must Learn from Conservative Success. His latest article at the Washington Post is What Joe Kennedy's Speech Says About Democratic Anger at Trump. But when you talk about Democratic anger, Paul, it seems that you're talking about the grassroots and the Democrats, or at least the Democratic establishment, in particular the DCCC, they always seem to run away from their base. They're looking for millionaires that can self-fund. There's some extraordinary examples of it happening out here in California. I mean, there's a guy that's running against Nunes, who I would think, you know, that would be one of the greatest acts of political necessity on the planet to get rid of that guy. His own hometown paper, the Fresno Bee, is basically implying that he might be a traitor and asking why is he going to bat for the Russians. But instead, the DCCC is backing some self-funder who his main positions are that he wants to bring back the death penalty and doesn't think Californians are sufficiently concerned about the Second Amendment, as opposed to a Latino in a largely Latino district in the Central Valley. So it's pretty amazing. And you've got Kyrsten Sinema running for the Senate in Arizona, who votes about 80% of the time with Republicans. She's likely to run against Martha McSally, a former A-10 fighter pilot, who, you know, if I was a voter in Arizona, I'd vote for the authentic Republican, not the imitation one. So there's a kind of lack of logic amongst the Democratic establishment that as long as you can get somebody elected with a D behind their name, you win. But if you got a bunch of centrist and conservative Democrats elected in these red-leaning states or red-leaning districts, they're not necessarily going to vote with you. And so what have you won?
Yeah, you know, the party in Washington doesn't always have a good sense of what is going to motivate voters. And that's particularly true of the DCCC. So, you know, the thing about what's happening right now on the Democratic side is that it's completely organic. You know, it isn't obviously the DNC is trying to do what they can to promote it. But, you know, the stuff that they try to do at a national level often just ends up not doing very much. You know, people might remember a couple of months ago when Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer and some of the other Democratic leadership tried to come up with a message that would sort of synopsize everything Democrats stand for, and they came up with this thing called a better deal, and they had a sort of a lame event to unveil it, and nobody cares about it anymore at all. But at the same time, you have this organically growing activism that has come up. And, you know, Indivisible is a great example. It was a few people who were former congressional aides who put up something that was sort of a guide for people to how the best way to influence their members of Congress. And it just exploded into something that is a real national movement and is promoting candidates all over the place. And it's not because those people are necessarily geniuses. It's because there was such a desire out there and people were looking for a way to channel it. And so, you know, the Democratic Party and Democratic leaders in Congress can be extraordinarily successful this year, not through any of their own efforts necessarily. You know, they may end up becoming the majority in Congress just because of this thing that happened and because, frankly, of Donald Trump. Even if they, you know, the best thing that they can do is, to a certain extent, is just get out of its way.
Right, but that's the issue, isn't it? Whether the DCCC and the DNC will get out of its way. And somebody wants to, recently on this subject, mentioned what Abba Iban said about Arafat, that the Palestinians never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity, and how much that might apply to the Democrats. And, of course, we know that the really inspiring Democrat that Bernie Sanders and others wanted to head the DNC, Keith Ellison, who's a Muslim, didn't get the job, and Tom Perez did, and he was behind that New Deal, or what did they call it? Better Deal?
Better Deal.
Yeah, that really took off like a house on fire, didn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, I think that that obviously can be a problem, and one of the things that happens is when there's a contested primary, the DCCC will come in, and their only concern often is who can raise the most money. And then they'll back that person. And yeah, that can be a real issue. But maybe they'll learn some lessons from what's happening right now, and that the person with the biggest fundraising base isn't always the one who's going to be the most effective and be able to motivate the most voters. And that really is the most important thing right now, is what is going to get Democrats excited. And, you know, they're already excited to a great degree. And we saw that throughout 2017 in places like Virginia and New Jersey and all over the place, even where Democrats lost, you know, in races like in Montana and Kansas and places, they dramatically outperformed what they normally would have done in those districts and states. And so, you know, you're really seeing this extraordinary desire out there for people to get to the polls, as long as Democrats can avoid screwing it up.
So you mentioned in your article, Paul Waldman, what Joe Kennedy's speech says about Democratic anger at Trump. You mentioned earlier about what he said that was really sort of inspiring and going back to Democratic roots, if you will, reminding Democrats of what they stand for. Let's just play that clip from last night's speech by Joe Kennedy.
This administration isn't just targeting the laws that protect us. They're targeting the very idea that we are all worthy of protection. For them, dignity isn't something you're born with, but something you measure by your net worth, your celebrity, your headlines, your crowd size. Not to mention the gender of your spouse, the country of your birth, the color of your skin, the God of your prayers. Their record is a rebuke to our highest American ideal, the belief that we are all worthy, that we are all equal, that we all count. In the eyes of our law and our leaders, our God and our government. That is the American promise.
And that was Joe Kennedy and the Democratic rebuttal to Donald Trump's State of the Union speech last night. again, Paul, the idea that the Republicans are great at getting their people out to vote, every last one of them, the Democrats have a natural majority, but they usually fail to inspire people to get out to vote. Your main argument here is that the inspiration's already happened. It's just a question of whether the party establishment will get out of the way and let it happen.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, you're right that it's the inspirational candidates who really motivate people. I mean, the highest turnout came when Barack Obama was running for president, and he was, you know, the most inspirational candidate Democrats have seen in a long time. And Democrats have often had a tendency to nominate for president people who are, you know, committed public servants with a long record of experience, but who aren't necessarily the most inspirational people. You know, candidates like Al Gore and Michael Dukakis and John Kerry and Hillary Clinton. And we saw in 2016, Clinton made a concerted effort to reach out to moderate Republicans. The theory, which seemed perfectly sound at the time, was that Donald Trump was such an extreme candidate and so repellent to so many people that there would be moderate Republicans who would be willing to cross over and vote for her if she made an appeal to them. Well, you know, it made a lot of sense at the time, but it turned out to be wrong. What happened was that they weren't persuaded by her. And all of those moderate Republicans swallowed whatever kind of misgivings they had about Donald Trump and voted for him. He got the same amount of Republican votes as Mitt Romney had and just John McCain had. So, you know, there was no turn away from him from the Never Trumpers. There may have been some of them, you know, who are columnists and things like that, but as an electoral phenomenon, it was non-existent. And that tells us something about what kind of a partisan era we live in, that even a candidate like Donald Trump won't turn away people from his party. And in that kind of an environment, the next Democratic candidate has to know that, you know, any efforts they make to persuade Republicans to cross over for them are just not going to work. And so they have to inspire their own voters to get out and vote.
Well, but it seems like they still haven't learned from Hillary Clinton's mistakes of seeing Bernie Sanders as the enemy. I mean, for God's sake, the guy that they chose as the vice president didn't do a damn thing for that ticket. Bernie Sanders would have got her over the top with a big majority. Polls indicate that he probably, had he run against Trump, and this is some of Trump's own polling as well, says that he might have beaten Trump. So there's a peculiar resistance to, and he had already shown that you can inspire young people and blue-collar people to get out and support you in droves. And he had, you know, it was all self-funded. He didn't go to Wall Street. She raised $1.4 billion and lost to Trump, who raised about $861 billion. So that's where I wonder about what I fear is that the same kind of mentality that froze Bernie Sanders out rather than embrace him and be grateful for the fact that he was bringing new voters to the polls. Do you share that concern? I mean, it mystifies me.
Yeah, I think that there's an extent to which money stops making much of a difference after a certain point. You can't win like a congressional election if you have no money, or if you can only spend, you know, $20,000 on your campaign. It's just not going to be possible if you're coming up against somebody who's spending $1 million or $5 million. But past a certain point, it really doesn't matter if you're the person who can raise $3 million or you're the person who can raise $6 million. There's only so many ads you can buy, and ads have very small effects. But it's true that, you know, in places like the DCCC, they are very, very focused on how much advertising, how much television advertising you'll be able to buy. And they even have a contract that they sign with candidates, where they agree to give the candidate help, and in return, the candidate pledges to spend most of their money on advertising. And that's very good for the Democratic consultant class, who, by the way, will be recommended by the DCCC. They'll tell you what media consultants you should hire and what direct mail consultants you should hire. And so there's very much of a kind of a system there that makes sure that a lot of people make money, but it doesn't really privilege grassroots organizing. And so it's particularly important if we're in the kind of partisan era that we are, and what matters is getting people to the polls. You know, advertising doesn't do it. So you need that kind of a grassroots network. But, you know, that's also something that not every candidate can generate. So, but you know, the part of the problem is that that's a little harder for them to judge. You know, that somebody from Washington can drop into your district and say, how much do you have in your bank account? And then they can say, okay, well, you've got this much and the other person has that much, and so they're doing better than you. But it's a lot harder for them to assess whether you're really going to be able to generate the excitement that will, you know, put together a grassroots movement that will, you know, rise up over the course of the election. And because they can't tell whether that's going to happen, they decide that they're just going to go by the bank account.
But the other bizarre part about it is, and this is the other asymmetry between the Democrats and the Republicans, it looks like the Republicans have pretty effective campaign people, particularly the guy that did their digital for Trump. Whereas on the Democratic side, you have this pantheon of well-paid losers, going back to Susan Estrich, you know, Bob Schrum, who was Hillary's first guy in 2008.
Mark Penn.
Yeah, Mark Penn collected, I can't remember how many millions he collected for losing. Podesta, apparently, in this round of Hillary's, collected $25 million and lost. So that's the other part of the I mean, if you have to go back to Carville to find a Democratic Party operative that really is effective and is going to win. They're all...
Well, I would say that the people who ran Barack Obama's campaigns did a very good
exactly.
job.
Exactly.
And but, you know, also that came from the fact that the person who... That it was Obama himself who kind of did the best job of setting the tone and making some of the most important judgments that allowed that campaign right. to be as effective as it was, both in 2008 and 2012. So you know, there are those people out there,
right.
but there are also a lot of people who, you know, fail upward and keep losing and keep getting business because they know the right people.
Right, and that's what you were just saying, that not only do they select these self-starters and millionaires like this Qualcomm heiress down in Orange County who's bound to lose, you know, literally an airhead heiress, but she's a self-starter. So they're going to go with her against, I think, Dana Rohrabacher, who, again, it would be the Lord's work to get rid of him along with Devin Nunes. So it's an amazing situation. But it looks like the motivation's there, and I guess we should be grateful for that, Ryan.
Yeah, I mean, I still think that for all the issues, this really does look like it's going to be a Democratic wave election, and you're not going to be able to stop all of those angry people from getting out to vote. So I think it's going to be very good for Democrats.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Paul Waldman.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Paul Waldman, who blogs at the Washington Post Plumline and is a columnist for The Week, as well as a senior writer at The American Prospect, the author of Being Right is Not Enough, What Progressives Must Learn from Conservative Success. And his latest article at the Washington Post is What Joe Kennedy's Speech Says About Democratic Anger at Trump. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into one of the more glaring lies in Trump's hour-and-a-half-long string of jingoistic patriotic platitudes mixed in with hyper-salesmanship at his State of the Union last night.